Welcome back to Bad Gay Movies. I am Bill Antoniou, and I did say in my intro last week something would happen as soon as I recorded it to make my intro immediately out of date, and war broke out like a minute after I recorded that, and then we recorded today's episode a while ago, which is also why you're not going to hear us talk about that, but I'm really hoping that by the time I record my next intro, the world will be completely at peace. Oh, well, we can dream. If there's anything you know about myself and Daniel Krolik from all the years you've been listening to us, it's that we love to talk about Madeline Kahn. And whether we're on a mic or not, we can just talk about Madeline Kahn for hours. So we capture lightning in a bottle a bit today, talking about another one of her, I'd say a handful of films that are, you know, that qualify to be on this show, which is Peter Bogdanovich's At Long Last Love. So hope you enjoy that, and after you listen to the show, I hope you leave us a rating and or a review anywhere that you listen to podcasts. We haven't had a review in like 1,000 years. I think it's because people don't really do them anymore, and if you don't, that's okay. But do please, if nothing else, tell other people about the show. Follow us on the socials, Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, Instagram. Visit us at badgaymovies.com. Write to us, badgaymovies2013@gmail.com, because, of course, I will be compiling options for the next season soon. And enjoy the show.
Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire, catching a glimpse of a movie star, sipping champagne with caviar, of witty chatter and snappy patter, of meetings by chance and maybe romance. Burt Reynolds, Sybil Shepherd, Madeline Kahn, Duilio Del Prete, Eileen Brennan, John Hillerman, Mildred Natwick, and you.
It's grand.
Are invited to a wonderful party. Peter Bogdanovich's delightful... And
welcome to Bad Gay Movies, and well, did you ever. I am your co-host, Bill Antoniou, and with me is...
What a swell party this is. It's Daniel Krolik.
Hello, Daniel. How are you?
I'm divine. How are you? I'm so happy. I'm so happy I finally saw what we're going to talk about from beginning to end.
So this was your first time watching it?
This was my first time watching it in full.
Okay.
I had seen bits and pieces over the years, but I had never seen the whole kit and caboodle.
I am not looking forward to being yelled at a lot for the next hour, but here we go.
What are you talking about?
And before he writes us, Jim Fall, yes, I know you love this movie. Today's movie is a 1975 classic. As Jay Cox wrote in his review, mounted with great expense and no taste, Peter Bogdanovich's At Long Last Love, our second Madeline Kahn movie that we've done on BGM, actually. So hello to William Madison as well.
So in the so the worst possible way this can go is just the next hour, the two of us talking about how much we love Madeline Kahn. That's the worst case situation.
I mean, that's, I'm happy to spend an hour doing that. Although I have a lot to say about her in this movie, and it's not, and I hold nothing against her whatsoever. I have no criticisms to offer of Madeline Kahn, but I do feel that she's done dirty in this film.
Yeah, I mean, they all have been, but keep talking.
Yes, but everyone else in this movie are people who I like, who are the wrong people for this movie, except maybe Eileen Brennan and John Hillerman too. But in terms of the lead,
but neither of them, I think both of them come across quite well, but neither of them are given enough to do to elevate anything else around them.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, I think they're the wrong people for the part. I think Sybil Shepherd. I think Peter Bogdanovich saw something in Sybil Shepherd, aside from her, you know, fabulous type.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. I think he saw something in her that she never actually gives, or that we never get from her as an audience member. You know, she's playing a Carol Lombard character, and she's not that person.
Yeah. She sort of reminds me of an earlier version of Allison Williams, whereas one person at one party said, you know, you have a really lovely singing voice. And then she never stopped singing.
Yeah. I mean, she's famously derided for being in this movie and for quote unquote not being able to sing. I would not accuse her.
She has a pleasant singing voice.
That's my problem, is I don't think she does. I think she can carry a tune. I don't think she's tone deaf, especially because they are all singing their songs live on the set.
Yeah. So which we can tell. And I think I get
sick of her voice after a very short period of time.
And I think shortly after this movie, she released an album called Sybil Does Cole Porter.
Oh my
and the
God.
Review said, and the review said, what did Cole Porter ever do to her?
Yeah. Or what did he do to everyone in this movie? This movie is made up entirely of Cole Porter songs. They pick maybe three of them that I know, and then a whole bunch of them that I don't. And a whole bunch that if I was putting together a Red Hot and Blue, should we say?
I was about to bring up Red Hot and Blue. Glorious album.
What a glorious album, and is how I got to learn Cole Porter songs
as
a teenager. Yeah.
Me too, yeah.
I don't know that anyone's ever done Down in the Depths better than Lisa Stansfield.
Except I was very surprised when years later I heard the real I've Got You Under My Skin, that it wasn't actually a rap about HIV.
What a shock. Yeah, because that album is made up of like standard versions of Cole Porter and then free interpretation.
And like the Swahili Begin the Begin.
Oh my God, that I always skipped. I couldn't do it. It was a bit too manic for me. But Sinead O'Connor does a traditional.
Again, gorgeous. And the video so she does with her in that wig, that Veronica Lake wig is. Yeah.
Directed by John Maybury. He was an associate of Derek Jarman's, and he also directed that movie Love is the Devil with Derek Jacobi as Francis Bacon.
Well, there was an MTV special where they gave music videos to, like, Lisa Stansfield had a music video.
Yeah.
Jodie Watley, Debbie
Red
Harry.
Blue?
Yeah.
It was an HBO special, actually, where it was just the album. They did like a special where I had it on Laserdisc. I don't remember if I still do.
I think that, I mean, I know that we're tangenting, but I think the most successful one is Debbie Harry and Iggy Pop singing Well Did You Ever.
So great, because they reinterpret it without abandoning the spirit of the original. Like
I hear they dismantled Pick Fair and then they start talking about Pia Zadora's house. It's great.
Yeah, it's so great. And although I like some of the tradition ones, like Jodie Watley singing After mm-hmm. Yoo-hoo, and the other one. Annie Lennox singing Every Time We Say Goodbye, which
Katie Lang doing So in Love.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So all these, and also In the Still of the Night, done by the Neville Brothers. Like there are mm-hmm. so many gorgeous Cole Porter songs, and so
the Thompson twins doing a very cheeky Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Yes, so great. Yeah. That, I mean, I'd rather talk about Red Hot and Blue, but that is not the case with At Long Last Love, which does have Down in the Depths. It has Friendship, which is not a Cole Porter song I ever knew.
It is. Yeah. I mean, it got reinterloped into Anything Goes. So it gets heard a lot. But the thing is that, I mean, I think this is a jukebox musical problem at large, but in this particular case, there's not enough plot to serve any of these songs because this movie has a plot that you can literally summarize in one sentence.
Yes. The plot is basically that two people meet, fall in love, two other people meet, fall in love, and then they switch partners. And
then they switch back. Yeah.
They do. And the partner swap doesn't really make sense because they never seem like you never get the sense of them actually falling in love. They just get together because they have.
And neither coupling comes across as any more or less compatible than another one.
Well, I mean, the only reason why Bert and Sybil seem compatible is because they're the stars of the movie and you're just assuming it. But. Although I know
that Sybil is a great famous beauty, especially in this era of her career, but Madeleine Kahn is stunning in this movie.
She is stunning, but
she's stunningly sexy.
Them as former schoolmates is a lot to ask of me, given that they are 8 years apart in difference in real life. And Sybil could play younger than her age. Madeleine, and I don't say this with any criticism, Madeleine never looked young. Madeleine always had a, you know, mature quality to her. And so them playing like they were schoolgirls together, it looks like Madeleine babysat her at some point. It does not look like they were ever the same age.
Sure.
But yes, as you say, the songs do not suit the plot, partly because Cole Porter was a brilliant lyricist. This movie was inspired because Sybil Shepherd gave Peter Bogdanovich a collection of his songs and as if he'd never heard them before. But anyway, it inspired him to make this musical. And he said it's because he loved that Cole Porter was unsentimental. You know, his lyrics are, they're quite savage, actually, in their wit and whatever.
And their body. Their yes. body and they're sexualized.
But they rarely tell stories. They're always about an emotional situation, which is either, you know, love, out of love, loneliness, or happiness. But they're never telling an actual story, so they don't really lend themselves to being written into a plot. And if they were, it's not a plot that Peter Bogdanovich ever came up with. Because, I mean, like, maybe the same argument could be made for ABBA, and yet they somehow managed to squeeze something out for them. My question is, has there ever been a successful movie musical pastiche where, not based on a Broadway play, where they created a musical and put a whole bunch of old songs in and wrote a plot around it? Has there ever been a good one?
Mamma Mia accepted.
Well, Mamma Mia is based on a play.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good question. And then there's stuff like
American in Paris, I guess, because that is a movie written around.
I mean, yeah, then we can talk like a lot of those Freed Unit movies were just repurposing old songs. Like technically Bill Singin' in the Rain is a jukebox musical.
Correct. Yeah.
Because so none of those songs or The Bandwagon, like none of those songs are really written for that story.
Cause Woody's Everyone Says I Love You is also this movie and it's better, but it's still not great.
I'm quite fond of Everyone Says I Love You. And it sort of has the same caliber of singers in the cast. Yeah. Like in that one, Goldie Hawn can sing and Alan Alda can sing and really nobody else. But what elevates, in my mind, Everyone Says I Love You is that you see the world around them becoming a musical. There are people breaking out into song and dance. And in this one, it's so awkward because nobody except the principals actually sing and dance.
Yes. It's like an Umbrellas of Cherbourg situation where it's a musical, but not like a performance musical where everyone just starts singing while they're strolling through the park. There's only a dance number in the nightclub, which is diegetic. Mm-hmm. He says he was inspired by movies like The Smiling Lieutenant and 1 Hour with You. And
I've never heard of either of those.
Well, movies. these are Ernst Lubitsch musicals from the early 30s. But
wow. Okay.
He's making this movie with character types that are from screwball comedies from the later 30s with music that would be more common in the late 30s, early 40s. Like Cole Porter becomes a movie musical guy in the 40s. He's not in the 30s. So then why are you basing it? Why are you inspired by Nelson Eddy and Jeanette McDonald movies where they sang opera?
Yeah. One of my favorite Hollywood tidbits is that when Peter Bogdanovich and Sybil Shepherd hooked up, Orson Welles moved in with them. Because he was on the downswing and he was penniless. So I'm wondering if
they because he wanted to watch.
I mean, who didn't?
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if they made this while they had to like nudge Orson Welles out of the way in the kitchen.
I wonder. So they're together from what, like 72, 71 to 78, I think is when.
Well, was this because there was this and Daisy Miller. So which one of these came first?
Year before.
Okay. Which was also a flop, right?
Huge. And it's terrible. Yep. It's terrible. And you know, I love me a Henry James adaptation and I have the patience of the ages to watch a Henry James adaptation. And it's also because she's terrible in that as well. Although many of the supporting actors in this movie are also in that movie and they're all fantastic.
Like whom?
Mildred Natwick, Eileen Brennan, Cloris Leachman is in that as well. She's fantastic. Yeah. But it's a bad film. So of course, for anyone who doesn't know, and of course you do know because I believe all you must remember this listeners also listen to Bad Gay Movies, but you can listen
to the Polly Platt series.
You can listen to her Polly Platt series. And in bullet point, basically, is that Peter Bogdanovich was married to Polly Platt. She worked on most of his movies, mostly in uncredited capacities. I think Paper Moon is her highest credit that she gets, which is
as a production designer. Yeah.
At which point I believe that they had already broken up because he would have gotten together with Sybil during Last Picture Show, which was 2 years before that. Mm-hmm. And then after he breaks up with Polly Platt, it's a huge, huge scandal in the press. And for many people, they feel that the bad reviews that his two movies with Sybil got were because people were reviewing their relationship and not reviewing the films. In the case of Daisy Miller, that movie really is terrible. In the case of At Long Last Love, it got reviews of something way worse than what I see. I don't think this movie is good, but I also don't think that it's the worst thing I've ever seen in my life.
I would agree. It's just uninspired.
It's limp. It's absolutely
limp. Yeah. Yeah.
It's also, it's a movie made in an era. The 70s is all about 30s nostalgia. The actual reason for it, I don't really know. I'm imagining it has something to do with Thinking back to the Depression, I mean, the economy is going fast and loose in the 70s in the States, and they're looking back at the Depression, which is remembered as the time when the economy was bad and people dealt with it in the right way. And maybe they felt nostalgic about that in the era of Vietnam. I don't know. But you have a lot of movies celebrating the 30s, like The Great Gatsby comes out the year before this, which is not the third. I think
it's the year, yeah. I also think it might be the propensity for running movies on television and the Dawn of the Midnight movie.
Yes,
so the fact that you could turn on your TV at 10 o'clock at night or at midnight and watch a Bubsy Berkeley musical.
Yeah, the 70s is considered when movies on television really exploded, because that's when studios decided to make TV their friend instead of their enemy. Mm-hmm. It's also why movies became the domination of teenage boys. Because movies were sold to women before that, but then women started staying home once the movies were
interesting. A few years before this, Bernadette Peters, I don't know if you've heard of her. No. Bernadette Peters, her big break was in this musical called Dames at Sea, which was a pastiche of 1930s. The understudy becomes the star.
Bernadette Peters looked me in the eye, you know. I know you were right next to me.
I was there.
She looked me right in the eye. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, if you don't already know, many years after this, there is a movie made called Irreconcilable Differences about Junior.
Oh, do we know about Irreconcilable Differences?
Which is loosely based on Peter Bogdanovich and Polly Platt's breakup, in which he gets a new blonde girlfriend played by a hilarious Sharon Stone. And he casts her in a movie musical of Gone with the Wind, and her singing is atrociously funny. It is so funny.
And who is playing the Polly Platt role? None other than the unheralded, done dirty Shelley Long.
And because of that, when I imagine Polly Platt, I always imagine her with a sharp, judgmental voice.
Yeah. And because neither of my parents listened to this podcast, I can divulge that the couple in Irreconcilable Differences met the same way that my parents did, is that the woman was hitchhiking and picked up the man.
That's amazing. I did not know this story. That's incredible.
My dad was actually hitchhiking with his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And my mom picked them both up.
Oh my God, that's so 70s when everyone used to hitchhike all the time.
And they weren't even trying to get they were trying to get from like one point to another in Montreal. Like, it wasn't a great distance.
According to a friend of mine who is our parents' age, that happened daily. And it was usually not a long journey. You were looking to get across town.
By the way, it ended for my parents about as well as it did for Shelley Long and Ryan O'Neal.
Well, my parents met because my dad almost ran my mother over, so it was also vehicular in nature.
Great.
And, it also ended badly, even though they stayed together. So believe me, there are many ways in which people can be unhappy. And as we learned from the movie about Cole Porter called The Lovely, there are many ways that people can be happy, even in an atypical union.
Yes. The big takeaway from that movie was that he buried Linda in the front yard of his house.
I forgot about that. I really wanted to like that movie because I love
Cole Porter.
It's not a good movie. And I don't like Kevin Kline in it. And I really like Ashley Judd in it. I think she's so lovely. And it is a great example of a story in which these two people genuinely did love each other, even though they were not our conventional idea of a great love story. You know, mm-hmm. I forgot that she died so young too.
Yeah, but I think if one would make a Cole Porter movie in our day and age, I think that notion of how that relationship would function would hopefully be a little bit more layered and colorful and
also something lighter to reflect the fact that his brilliant lyricism came from somewhere. I mean, obviously he had his rough moments
he had that accident.
That accident that like marred him for life, and that he had to deal with that all the time. And that, you know, his brilliant lyrics came out of making, you know, something bright out of something dark. But that movie is miserable. Like, it's a moody, gloomy movie. Mm-hmm. And it's a shame, because Kevin Kline could certainly play, a debonair, lighthearted fellow making the best.
And he's a musical person. Yeah, what I did appreciate about this movie was the really stunning. At long last love. What I did appreciate about this was Madeline accepted and Eileen Brennan accepted was the black and white production design and the black and white costumes.
So he did not want to make another movie in black and white because he'd made a few at this point. And so he made the decision to make a black and white in color movie. And it is beautiful. I always love the fact that period movies reflect the period they were made more than the period they're
depicting. Yeah.
And there is a way that the 30s looks in the 1970s that is all over this film. And I don't have a single problem with
also,
it.
Also, case in point, New York, New York.
Yes, absolutely.
Has a similar feel. Yeah.
I wonder if it's like the quality of the hair care products or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. In the same way that like Victorian movies made in the 60s look very much like 60s movies.
Sure.
And yeah. I always think, but now we've gotten it down right, but it's only because we're living in our own time. Like now when I watch period movies from the 90s, I can tell that they're 90s movies, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because at the
yeah.
time they looked just like real.
They look like movies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, I absolutely love the look. I love the audacity to have so many reflective surfaces and somehow, to my viewing, not catch a single camera reflection in any of them because that could.
Oh, that's a good point. Because yeah.
it's all like plated tables and chairs and everything.
I love every single all white interior.
Yes. Yeah. Although it would have been fun. I don't say this as a criticism. It would have been fun to have a moment with like one colored dress that pops out for some
odd sure. reason. But that's also Madeline's hair. That's her like gorgeous yeah, orange yeah, hair.
Yeah. yeah. Although I will say, and Madeline is also like, she suits the period. Like you could see Madeline being like an Alice Brady or a Carol Lombard or, you know, something like that from the time.
Yeah.
While a Sybil never blends in, Sybil looks like she's in costumes the entire time. And I know that it is, again, he's looking at her beauty and her blonde hair, but Sybil has this like, she's a Texan. She swings hard. She lands hard. She's tough. Like Sybil really comes into her own many years later for a reason. And it's because her personality suited her age better later.
But it's funny because she had this great success with moonlighting.
Yeah.
But moonlighting is also a throwback to 1930s screwball comedies.
Yeah, I guess it worked with her humor better because she's not funny.
And she was old, but you're right, she was older. Like she
is older. Yeah, 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 yeah. And I say that, like I said, I like her a lot. I feel yeah. like she's ill-used in both of the movies she made with him. And again, it is because he sees something in her that's either not there or that's not coming across.
Also, because none of the central foursome are given anything resembling a backstory or yes. a character or history, they're all sort of left to their own devices. And I think because of that, Sybil's so at sea because she's relatively unseasoned
yeah.
and somebody like Madeline, who is of the theater and yeah. who has done Broadway at this point in her career, sort of can pull it off without this great backstory or history. Yes.
And he probably did it because he was looking at movies from the 30s where a lot of those characters didn't have backstories either. Like you got Carol Lombard, you got Clark Gable, and you just knew who they were because they were such definable types.
Sure.
And they were famous for a shtick. They were also churning out like 16 movies a year because they worked on a different schedule back then. And they were also working for much tighter scripts where the mechanics of the scripts were airtight. I mean, everything about them was so beautifully. Things like, what's the plot device in this movie?
Sybil is penniless because her mother stopped sending her money.
Right. Which is such a dumb stake for her to have, which is that like she is a rich girl, but her mom's just late with her allowance.
Well, basically. No, I mean, it's not a dumb stake. It's the fact that the movie treats it like a dumb stake.
Well, yeah, but
it doesn't need to be.
Right. And like a good 30s movie would open with a scene of her finding this out.
Yeah.
But it would be something like you have to get married by this date in order to get your inheritance. Like something much stronger.
For sure. But one of my notes was at the top of this movie, every single one of the four main characters has an establishing song. And by the end of the fourth, I still have no idea who any of these people are.
Well, because Bert doesn't really have what's his deal? Like he's rich and he's lazy and that's just about it. Like he's not in danger of losing anything.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have like, not Mr. Deeds. What's the story that I'm thinking of where it's again, his, you know, and that's what
or
happens.
Or even Arthur or like,
yeah, like Arthur. Comedies from the 30s yeah. were always about like finding the negative side of being extremely rich. Cause you got to indulge yourself watching these people live these lavish lifestyles. And then they were made relatable by the fact that they had problems. And usually mm-hmm. in a character like his, it would be that his dad is sick of paying for everything. He's saying to him, you got to get a job
by
September 1st or else you are completely cut off. And like
this one, I think the problem is his mother is just too delightful.
Well, we're going to get into that. But the other thing I was going to say about Burt Reynolds, and again, I love Burt Reynolds, as Blanche Devereaux said, sexiest man in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
He is not quite Clark Gable because Clark Gable was like debonair and handsome. And then he had a streak of like wild goofiness in him, which Burt doesn't have. Burt is way too self-conscious and he comments on himself a bit too much.
And he can move like he can when he has to dance sure. and when he has to tap and waltz because he's an athlete, he can move so he doesn't look awkward moving his body and dance.
He only looks awkward at the end when he's wearing a swimsuit that has peekaboo sides.
What the fuck? Why does this swimsuit have cutouts? I wrote that down.
So good.
But, and it's not quite a full Russell Crowe thing where he looks resentful and angry to be there. Like, no. he looks game. He just doesn't look like he knows what he's supposed to be doing.
Well, if you told me that everybody's scenes in this movie were them goofing off when they thought that they were between takes, I would fully believe you, because most people are like not on their game, or when they are, they look confused.
Although, who has been hornier than Eileen Brennan in this movie?
Jesus Christ, she is so horny. My God. And I love John Hillerman as the, you know, perfect butler type.
He was delightful. I've never seen him before.
Oh, because you never watched Magnum P.I.
Oh,
yeah,
okay. He was
on Magnum P.I. My friend's dog Higgins was.
I mean, I watched Magnum P.I., but I don't think I was paying attention to John Hillerman.
No, because there were too many tiny Bermuda shorts in your way and giant handlebar mustaches. Oh, that man can shoot his guns in my face any day. Yeah. Ooh.
Speaking of hairy chest, this movie has something in common with What's Up, Doc, where Ryan O'Neal shows up in that weird Chippendales moment with just the bow tie and no shirt.
So the actor who I don't recall from anything else, he was in two Bogdanovich movies and apparently was a famous Italian dubber and actor, Duilio Del Prete, is super sexy when he takes off his jacket and he's just wearing his dickie underneath. Mm-hmm. I appreciated that very much. Even if it is the 70s and you're going to have to deal with a hairy shoulder or two. Mm-hmm. James Caan, need I say more?
case in point, I watched Modern Romance recently.
I watched it too. It is so funny.
It's really good. It's so really funny. Toxic. And I think it's a little bit ahead of its time.
Yes, absolutely.
In terms of this codependent relationship where neither party is good for the other one. Yes. But I went on Letterboxd again and everybody was complaining about Albert Brooks's body hair.
Yeah, because
they're like, how could he go on screen? Yeah,
because no one cared. I mean, if they had anything to say about it, it certainly wasn't anything damning. But yeah, his curly hair is exactly the same on his shoulders and his back. It's hysterical. But that part where he's just telling everyone, like when he's like parking at that store, he's like, oh, I just broke up with someone. I just need to park here for a couple hours. Like, he has to tell everyone that he just went through a breakup. It is so funny. That scene where he takes that woman out and then he drives around
the block. He leaves her.
And,
oh,
God, so good. Anyway.
Oh, and in that movie, that woman is an editor for a Peter Bogdanovich movie.
Is she? Oh, that's right.
The character.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. You're right. Is Sybil the only living cast member from this movie?
She is.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that while I was watching it.
Yeah, including the director. Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, unless if Mildred Natwick faked her own death and is living in Bali somewhere.
So, I don't get why Mildred Natwick isn't. I mean, I don't get why anyone is in this movie because they're not doing anything. But like, she shows up. She has a bit of a number, I guess. And I love Mildred Natwick. This is her fresh off her entering the Spice Girls rotation. Not fresh. It's been a few years. It's been like 8 years.
What was her nomination for?
Barefoot in the Park.
Okay. Yeah.
So in case anyone doesn't know, Daniel and a friend of the show and frequent guest host Greg Roseborough are casting the Spice Girls using Best Supporting Actress nominees who have only been nominated once and they cannot have won.
With no win.
Correct. Yeah. And Mildred is for sure a posh Spice. I think she's a posh Spice. I think Eileen is a scary Spice.
Eileen?
Or sporty, but I think she's a scary.
I think Eileen is like on the cusp of sporty and scary.
Yeah. But Mildred is a posh to me. What else is she going to be? Baby Spice? She's 150 years old.
She could be a ginger, but I don't think she's saucy enough to be a ginger.
No, she's not. I don't think. I mean, at least from, I only know her in older roles. Also, she's more of a stage actress, so I don't know if she did much as a young woman. But
well, also, according to my estimation, there is only one Ginger Spice, and that, my friend, is Patricia Clarkson. It's a fun game. Play along at home, everybody. It is a fun
game. Everybody, write in your selections. Jennifer Jason Leigh is easy. We already know. But write in all your other selections.
Toni Collette is a sporty.
Toni Collette is for sure a sporty. Yeah.
Taraji is a posh.
Yeah. And Madeline is disqualified, unfortunately.
Because she has two.
Because of Mel Brooks. Mm-hmm.
Carol Channing is the baby.
Carol Channing is for sure a baby and was nominated alongside Mildred Natwick. They were both 67. And they both
who beat them?
Estelle Parsons.
Oh, that's a good loss, though.
She would not have been a Spice Girl, even if she hadn't won, because she was nominated again a year later.
For Rachel,
yeah. Yep. As the screaming lesbian. She's a screaming something and everything, and she's a screaming lesbian in that one.
And still with us, yeah.
She must be in her 90s, is she not?
Yeah, and she still pops up on the Roseanne spinoff every now and then.
Amazing. Good for her. I have not kept up with the Connors. So, as I said, they sing live. They sing their numbers live on the set in this movie, which apparently caused a lot of problems because most of them are not trained singers. And they are paying tribute to a kind of musical, to a kind of movie made in a time when they used to do like 90 takes of musical numbers to get them exactly right. So, I applaud the bravery of it, but it's
is not. Another reason why there's no singing or dancing ensemble?
I wonder.
Because everything was live?
Yeah, I wonder about that. But also, everyone sounds worse than they should because they're singing live, including Madeline Kahn. Her songs always sound like they're in the wrong key for her, and they always sound like she's...
Although straight. I did, when she opened up with Down in the Depths, I did appreciate that radical octave change up to her head voice.
Yeah, which is very her. That's a very her thing. But like, I do not need to point out to anyone that Madeline Kahn was an incredible singer. We all know because we've seen her sing in a billion things. So why doesn't she sound great in this movie? She doesn't sound bad, but she doesn't sound great. She sounds as mediocre as the rest of them do. Because Bert also doesn't embarrass himself in either movie musical that he does, but he doesn't, you know, make us...
What do you mean? What was the second movie? Oh, Best
Little Whorehouse, yeah.
He doesn't have much to sing in that, though, does he?
No, but he sings, and it's fine. And Dolly loved working with him, and, you know, she insists that he was... Like, he doesn't embarrass himself in either case, but he doesn't make me want to tell him to quit his day job either.
Right.
Know? And, you know, Madeline's better than that, but she's not up to her standard. And I wonder if it is because of the strain of having to sing live on set, because you're also not doing it just once. You're doing it a million times.
Yeah, I mean, the only other instances I could think of movie musicals singing live is obviously Les Mis.
Yeah.
And the Bette Midler Gypsy. But yes. I don't know if it was just Bette or if it was the entire company that was singing live.
I don't know that either. I know it was definitely Bette, but that's also Bette Midler. I mean, you're talking about a world-class athlete. Of course, you're going to let her pull a stunt. You know, not a stunt, but you know what I mean. You're going to let her show off in that regard because you know she can do it. Also, because she was always pissed off that she never got to do the play. So this was her way of getting to do that. While as in this case, just have them lip sync their... The long takes are also the reason why when they're in that horse... That horse race scene, there is a fly crawling all over Sybil Shepherd's hat.
No, I didn't catch that.
Yeah. That no one did anything about because they couldn't cut.
Well, it also sort of reminded me of the movie version of The Producers, where sometimes it was like the camera was set up for the musical number and then the director just went and had a cigarette. Totally. And came back when it was over.
What a mediocre film of such a wonderful musical. Yeah.
Yeah.
In Evita, there are some songs in that where they sing live on set. And it's really obvious. You can suddenly hear them breathing. Like, it's bad how different it is, where it's like, you know, this should have been done a little bit more organically. We also have one of Bert's heavier toupees in this film. One of his...
Was he using a toupee this early?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He had thinning hair from already. Yeah, yeah, for sure. That's a toupe for sure. Even though all 70s men's hair looks like toupees when you look at them in retrospect.
It does, yeah.
But yeah, for sure. Also, why not just actually remake a Cole Porter musical? Like, I'm sure the rights of something would have been available to just either adapt one of his plays or remake an earlier film or something.
The thing is, because Cole Porter was working sort of, he was most productive before the advent of Rodgers and Hammerstein. So very few of his shows actually survived the decades. Like Kiss Me, Kate did.
Yeah.
And Anything Goes did, but in a very heavily revised version.
Yeah.
But beyond those two, there's no Cole Porter book musical in heavy rotation. So the only way to get those songs circulating for a contemporary audience is to sort of repurpose them.
Right.
And I guess High Society, but even the stage, there's been several stage versions of High Society and they've all kind of failed.
It would have been better to just remake that movie, even though in 1975, you're only 20 years out. And Grace is still alive, but they're all still alive.
But Sybil is sort of at, like, she could be, I don't know.
No, she could be. I mean, her toughness and her smarts are always her secret weapon. That's why she's so great in what she's great in this era. Like The Heartbreak Kid, which is one of the funniest movies ever made. And she's so perfect because on the, you know, she is the absolute ideal perfection of blonde beauty, but then she has this stink eye that she gives him all the time that is so funny. Just her looking at him is so funny.
Yeah. Also, I know that we're not doing recommendations anymore, but if we were, I would recommend her autobiography, Sybil Disobedience.
Oh, I have not read that.
Where half of it is her hangups with Christine Baranski and the other half is her hangups with Bruce Willis.
Yeah, I don't get the impression that she's like a a picnic to be around.
And a wonderful story of her going to Ryan O'Neill's house to sort of, you know, as a meeting. And then he comes on to her and she says, I'm really sorry. I'm with somebody I'm not interested. And he says, get the fuck out of my house then.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in that we're definitely on Sybil's side because he pretty much did that
completely
definitely. And broke Angelica Houston's nose. Oh, the other thing I would recommend is that people watch clips of her as Martha Stewart in that TV movie, which I've never actually watched,
which was filmed Martha here. Stewart.
Was it?
Yeah.
It looks insane. Is it like a Lifetime movie? Is that what it is?
I think so. I also think there were two.
Okay.
I think she made a follow-up.
Interesting. Also, Cole Porter exists in the world of this movie, which is also, did you notice Madeline Kahn is starring in, and her being an actress is something that I also feel is very loosely dropped in and doesn't really seem to have much to do with the plot.
I mean, it does give us the only real successful number of the movie, which is the Primitive Man number.
Okay. But again, why are there all these Cole Porter songs in this movie that I've never heard of? Because I'm relatively familiar with his catalog, and you would think that people coming to see a Cole Porter pastiche musical would be expecting all the most famous hits. So it's like, if you are repurposing them and not using one of his older shows, why aren't you using more of his standards?
I think we got a chunk of fair hits, though. We got like I Get a Kick Out of You and Friendship and Down in the Depths.
Yes.
And The Lovely. I think we got it. I think we got like a big chunk of, familiar Cole Porter songs.
I guess so. It feels like there should have been more. There are too many of them that I don't know. I don't know her Caveman song. I've never heard that song before.
Mm-hmm. Patti LuPone covers it.
Okay. I would like to know what Madeline thought of herself in that black dress, because she is, you know, perfectly beautiful. She was also incredibly self-critical and very paranoid about being overweight on film. Mm-hmm. And she looks cute as a button throughout this entire film. And then suddenly in that dress, she looks dumpy.
But it also gets ripped off of her.
Yeah. And then she's like tiny underneath. For some reason, there's something about the way that silk dress sits on her, which today she would have worn with Spanx or something underneath to really like pull in a few of those lumps. But I wonder what she had to say about that, because she hated how she looked in Paper Moon.
That's right.
That's what made her go on a diet.
And she's so sexy in Paper Moon.
Well, she was always perfect to us, and she was always severely flawed to herself. This was her tragedy. Yeah. I also think Friendship is a poor song choice for that scene. Like, that's not the song they should be singing in a nightclub to get them all together. And also, who cares that you guys have known each other? Why do we need a song about that? Because the other thing about these songs and how they're written into this extremely vague plot is that the songs highlight things that don't need like emotional expression in any way.
Well, there's no emotions to express.
Well, there's that, yeah. But it's like, hey, we've known each other a long time. Let's sing a song about the fact that we've known each other a long time. No, you should be singing about the song about the fact that you're attracted to your friend's partner.
And there's no real friction when the partners get switched on. I mean, Madeline the Italian, when they at the country club, when they catch Bert and Madeline, or when they catch Bert and Sybil making out behind the tree, they're very blasé about it.
Yeah. Why not just be so open, so fourth wall breaking to the point where they look at each other and say, well, we are the supporting actors in this. Like, we are the, you know, B-level talent. So we might.
And that could work. And I just, I'm just looking over at my notes. And I also wrote down Bugsy Malone, which I think did the 20s and 30s pastiche much, much better than this movie.
Yes. Although I don't like that movie either. I know that.
I like it.
Well, because it's insane. And I appreciate that it goes all the way. I just find it kind of boring. Like, I wish the plot was a little bit better, but it is amazing how Scott Baio, just speaking of Dean Cain last week, like, Scott Baio, what another tragedy that we've lost that one to the dark side, because that guy was all charisma from when he was a kid, and also so handsome in his prime.
Right up to Blah 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 in Arrested Development.
That's right. But, and also in Bugsy Malone, what they do is like the joke of having them all lip sync to adult singers as well. That movie is self-consciously wry, and it's pure insanity. It's something the 70s only could have created.
Completely. Gangster children?
Yes.
Only in the 70s.
Like adults, and then shooting
whipped cream
at each other. Yeah. Serious question.
Please hit me.
At Long Last Love better or worse than Lost Horizon, the musical?
Oh, I think it's...
Because when they were both announced as the worst musical in decades.
How do you define better and worse, though?
Yeah.
Because I think Lost Horizon is a more unbelievable movie, which in my mind makes it better. But I also like to think of, and I know you do too, we like to think of ourselves as Madeline completists.
Yeah.
And I don't think, especially in this era, I don't think Madeline's arc would be complete without this movie.
Okay, but that's not
it. But even... even with that, okay, I would say
you're about to be put into a 7-year long coma for whatever reason. And you have only time to watch one movie. And for some reason, the only two options I have are at
Lost Horizon
and Lost Horizon. It's going to make you grateful.
It's hard because I will tell my invisible grandchildren about Lost Horizon, the movie musical.
Right.
But also, I don't want to give up the Madeline performance.
Okay.
So no, Lost Horizon.
I mean, it is grander. Yeah.
And it's more insane.
Yes. Yeah. It goes.
There's something more reasonable at Long Last Love, and there's something more insane about Lost Horizon.
Yes.
So absolutely. let's give the win to Lost Horizon, Bill.
At Long Last Love has been rehabilitated by a lot of people as sort of like a misunderstood classic. I understand why.
I wouldn't go that far.
Yeah.
I'm happy to have seen it. And I'm happy with many elements of it, but I wouldn't go that far.
Well, I mean, it was a long time before I saw it because it was not available on home video for decades. Like, it came out on cassette in 1980 and then disappeared and never was re-released until a Blu-ray in 2013.
But I remember this movie from reruns on Bravo.
Oh, interesting.
Flipping through Bravo like late at night and finding bits and pieces of this movie.
It took me a long time to finally watch it. I think I got around to it a couple years ago, probably around the time that I had read that Madeleine Kahn biography, which, by the way, made me cry by the end, even though I knew how it ended.
Thank you, William Madison. Yeah.
Thank you, William Madison. Daniel already recommended it, but we cannot recommend it enough. Read his biography. But anyway, I boned up my effort to watch a few of the movies of hers that I had not seen, like that and The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes's Smarter Brother. Mm-hmm. And we did, what's the movie?
Happy Birthday, Gemini.
I was going to say Happy Birthday, Gallipoli. So I finally watched it. And by the time I watched At Long Last Love, I had read everything there was to read about it. And the reviews lead you to believe that you're going to watch an absolute travesty of filmmaking that's going to make you hate life. And, you know, I don't know that it needs to be rehabilitated as a misunderstood classic, but I also don't know. I also understand people wanting to, you know, backtrack on this incredibly vicious treatment that it got, because I think Burt Reynolds was right when he said they were reviewing their relationship instead of the movie itself.
And it is. And when you look at the arcs that not only Madeline, but that Sybil and Peter Bogdanovich had in the 1970s and Burt Reynolds, like there's something interesting about where this movie fits into the larger picture of these people's lives.
Oh, absolutely. It's also a movie that, depending on when you saw it and how, there's like four different versions of it floating out there. And I believe,
I feel like we got some kind of an extended version.
Yes. It's now considered the definitive version with Peter Bogdanovich's blessing. I believe it was reassembled by an editor for the Blu-ray release, or it went to Netflix in like 2012 or something. I don't think it's anymore. American Netflix, I believe.
Okay.
So that's the version we're watching. I think people in the theater would have watched it maybe 15 minutes shorter version. I cannot imagine hating this movie that much, because for me, I am much angrier about a movie that is long and boring than I am about a movie that is shorter and innocuous. Like, when it's light as a feather and doesn't delight me, doesn't entertain me, but also it happens and then it's over and nothing happened. Like, that never bothers me as much as a movie that goes on and on and on forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's no smugness attached to it.
Yeah.
Like clearly Bogdanovich was biting off more than he can chew, but there's no, like, I have a feeling if this movie was made in 2023, it would be like an Adam McKay joint and it would be insufferable.
Yeah, and also that's kind of the problem, is that there's no smugness to it. Like, there's so little smugness that there's actually zero effort, it feels like.
Sure. Even though
they're all like, you know, putting on costumes and doing musical numbers, and yet they feel like no one's trying to do anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
And something that I really don't agree with is that he took out an ad in Variety not long after it was released to apologize for this movie and its poor quality, and it's just like,
He's a regular Billy Eichner, isn't he?
Well, why are you apologizing to people? Sometimes your movies work out and sometimes they don't. He had an unfortunate trajectory because he breaks out as a huge success in the beginning of his career. He has Targets, which is really does really well with critics, especially. Mm-hmm. And then The Last Picture Show, you know, wins 2 Oscars and announces him as one of these wunderkinds of the new American cinema in the 70s. He continues on a roll with a big success of What's Up, Doc, which is a much better tribute to 30s movies than this is.
And that's Madeline's film debut.
Correct. And also a better version of You're the Top as well, I will say.
Oh, right. Yeah. I forgot about that.
And then Paper Moon, which is maybe his masterpiece, although I like Last Picture Show as well. And then after that, he just never recovers. I mean, this
with the exception of, I don't know about you, I have a very soft spot for the movie version of Noises Off.
Yes, but in terms of him being
relevant and
An A-list director and being, you know, what he does have good movies after that, but none of them really make an impression. He that movie Nickelodeon didn't do well. Daisy Miller and At Long Last Love.
What's the one with Ben Gazzara in Thailand or something?
Is that They All Laughed with Audrey Hepburn?
No, although I do recommend that. That one's really something.
That's like, I think that might be her only movie I've never seen.
Oh, I have the DVD. I bought it at a going out of business sale
as well. But if I can't find it, I'll ask you for it.
And it's Dorothy Stratton's first and last movie.
Yeah. And then after she died, he married her little sister.
Yeah. And was with her until he died.
Yeah. Which is a bit of a Woody Allen situation.
Sure. Yeah, don't disagree. He married her. Do not disagree. Yeah.
She was 20 and she looked like her sister.
And the mother moved in with them.
Yeah. Yeah. Special. He also, the movie The Cat's Meow is okay. That's like his second last feature. And then,
that's Kirsten Dunst, right?
Yes. It's okay. It's not great, but it's good. And then his last movie is really bad. The She's Funny That Way with Jennifer Aniston.
I do have a soft spot for Noises Off, and I think it translates, but I also think it translates a play that on paper is untranslatable to film quite well and better than anybody else thought it would.
Yeah, totally. Well, it's also, you can't go wrong with Carol Burnett. I mean, she's always the right choice. She's just brilliant.
Really? Yeah.
I saw Noises Off at Soul Pepper a few years ago and I really liked it.
It's foolproof.
Yeah.
If everybody's in the right place, I think it's foolproof.
Yeah, no, it is. It was really, really good. And the star of it was also in Coal Mine's Killer Joe, which was made into a film by William Friedkin, who also just died.
Which is a good movie.
Yeah,
Killer Joe.
Good movie. Yeah, and it's a good
Gina play. Gershon and Matthew McConaughey. Yeah.
Also, the Latin lover, Johnny Spanish, as he is known, he has an obsession with Annie comics that is very strange, and I don't
know. Little Annie Orphan?
Yeah, like, among the many things in this movie I don't understand is why that's there all the time.
No, I wrote it down, too. I wish I could tell you. And again, you can keep the sort of frothiness and fluffiness of the 1930s and this vibe of everybody having a good time while the rest of the world goes to hell, but give them some stakes to play. Yeah. You know, if he's penniless, give him some emotional weight about, oh my goodness, how can I tell this beautiful woman that I have no money and she thinks I'm going to save her?
Well, especially like,
give us something.
It's so shocking the level of effort that are put into the look of this movie. I mean, set after set that all look like Superman's home planet. And these gorgeous costumes, everything for sure costs money. He is at the top of his career, so he's for sure being given carte blanche to do whatever he wants. Mm-hmm. I think the budget was like $6 million or something, which is a lot of money for a movie at the time. And then you phone in a script that's that weak. First of all, why is Posh Spice Bert's mother and not part of the plot? If Sybil's having trouble getting money out of her mother, why isn't she her mother and have a number and come up from Florida to yell at her for something?
Yeah. Although Mildred Natwick has the best line in the movie, which is, I have to go. The captain's going to show me his lighthouse.
I love that line too. I love, and you know, of course he's playing with the conventions of the double entendres. I mean, not that there were ever overt double entendres in 30s movies, but censorship, screwball comedies were all born out of the necessity to get around censors.
But I like to talk about, because all the 1970s auteurs seem to have gotten their shot at a movie musical.
Yes.
Because Coppola did One from the Heart, Scorsese did New York, New York.
Yeah.
Woody eventually, much, much later, did Everybody Says I Love You.
And Bogdanovich claims he made it because he watched this movie three times in the theater.
I'm sorry?
Bogdanovich said that Woody made Everyone Says I Love You because of the fact that he'd watched At Long Last Love three times in the theater.
Really?
I think Woody said to him to be nice. He said, I saw it three times in the theater.
All right, girl.
Yeah.
But am I missing any?
No, you're probably not. Did Friedkin do a musical? I don't think so. Is Cruising kind of a musical? I mean,
Schlesinger? What are you doing?
Oh, I feel like he did, and now I'm going to kick myself for not. I feel like John Schlesinger did a musical. Who directed Oh, What a Dirty War?
Oh, What a Lovely War?
Oh, no, that's Richard
Attenborough. Oh, Attenborough. Yeah. Who did two? He gave us two for the price of one because he later did a chorus line.
Yeah. John Huston is not a 70s filmmaker, but he gave us Annie.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he gave me Annie.
Yeah.
It felt like,
no, I watched it every day as a child. It was mine too.
It felt like he gift wrapped it and left it on my doorstep.
It's true. But yes, and a lot of that is because of the fact that they are watching 30s and 40s movies learning to be directors. And also Bogdanovich is someone who was like the French New Wave guys, which is that he was also a film critic before he became a filmmaker and remained a film critic and a film archivist for the rest of his artistic career. So
I know it comes around a little bit later, but it also in my mind it calls back to Pennies from Heaven.
Oh, okay.
The Herbert Ross movie.
Yeah.
Which I guess is what, like 80?
81.
79, 80?
Yeah.
But it's still, but it has that feel. But the musical numbers in that movie are so, I mean, everybody's lip syncing to the original song, so it's a little bit different. But the musical numbers in that movie are so insane, but they're a direct comment onto whatever is going on around them.
Yeah. The layers of that movie are fascinating.
And I know that it's driving for a seriousness that this movie doesn't pertain to, but...
But what is this movie driving for? Because it also doesn't capture lightheartedness at all. And it does, I like the fact that there are tips of the hat to conventions of 30s movies. I love the joke of the milkman leaving two bottles of milk and two bottles of vodka on the front door. That's really funny. If you blink, you miss it, but it's really funny.
I enjoyed the country club orchestra that consisted entirely of old ladies in tiaras.
Yes. And then there's also like, it takes place in the milieu that a lot of those movies take place in, like, you know, beauty parlors, fancy dress shops. When she is doing her face, that's a sight you see in a lot of 30s movies. Although I don't understand why she's got what look like condoms all over her face when she's got that facial stuff.
Oh, that was the cucumber facial.
Okay, just use a white cream. That's all you had. Just put a cold cream on her. You didn't need to go. That looked weird.
So you said Eileen. You said you found Eileen Brennan to be miscast.
No, she's probably She's probably one of the people who's not miscast. It's the main people, particularly Bert and Sybil, that I feel are miscast. They're not. They're two huge stars of their time, which is why they're in this movie. But they're not like right for those parts.
And they look good together.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did they do anything else together? I feel like they must have.
Maybe one of them popped. Maybe did she pop up on Evening Shade? Did he pop up on Moonlighting?
Maybe.
Like, was there a TV thing?
And it's not. It's only a year after this that she's also in Taxi Driver, which is a real left field turn for her.
Oh, for sure.
In this period. And at the end, it looks like she's dancing with Billy Zane. Did you notice that?
Where she's dancing with the Italian guy?
Yeah. Not the Italian guy. She's dancing with some rando. Because remember, they go to that dance to make the boys jealous.
Oh, sure.
The barest attempt at a plot. And then it looks like she's dancing with Billy Zane.
But at that point, like, it honestly didn't matter who was going to end up with whom.
Yeah, no, none of us cared. And I mean, we're set up for this because of the little Glockenspiel.
And you knew that Bert and Sybil had to be together because they're the two big stars.
Yeah.
But dramatically, Bert could have ended up with Madeline and it would have been the same movie.
Yeah, there's never a Philadelphia Story scene where they like stay up too late and get drunk, or it's like no one has. I guess
there's the swimming pool with the cutouts, but
I guess so, but not really.
Yeah,
and then also like her mom finally sends her money, and then she decides to go and spend it all shopping. And again, I don't buy her as this kind of like feather-brained, spoiled society girl, because Sybil has a grounded, take no prisoners common sense to her. And so it
also
makes it seem like she's manic or like there's a psychological problem.
And you're right. She always comes across as somebody who's going to land on her feet no matter what life deals her.
Yeah. Well, as opposed, because I know that the character is meant to be something of a tribute to Carol Lombard, particularly in My Man Godfrey, as this like spirited but shallow, like someone who is shallow because that's the life she's been leading and doesn't realize she's got more, you know, which is not what Sybil gives us in this movie. And had he written to her character more accurately, she would have been so much better.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say about this movie, other than the fact that in the credits it says Hair by Carrie White, and that made me laugh because that would be an intense hair.
Do you mean Hair by Scary White?
Creepy Carrie. Creepy Carrie.
Also, Madeline's character's name was Kitty O'Kelly, which was practically the name of the celebrity biographer from the 1980s.
Kitty Kelly. Yes, I used to call Robert Keller Kitty Keller all the time.
Yeah.
Kitty Kelly. That's so funny. And then it turned out, and it was her stage name because her real name was something like...
Kathy
Conran or something. This is like, why did you make it?
Well, I was going to say there's no way Madeline's getting into the country club in 1935.
Yeah. So like, why didn't you, why wasn't a stage name for Kathy Konigsberg or something like that? I don't know. I just used Woody Allen's real name because that was the first Jew name that came to mind. By the way, stay tuned, everyone, for Daniel's version of the Leonard Bernstein story.
I just read a very awkward defense of the Bradley Cooper nose written by Mark Harris, who's the, you know who Mark Harris is?
Yes, he wrote absolutely. Is it the one where he says Maisel is Jewface and Bernstein is not, or is that somebody?
He didn't mention Maisel. It was for Slate Magazine, and it's.
Because someone wrote an article that basically, because Maisel's people are acting Jewish stereotypes, that's...
Well, I'm of the Sarah Silverman school, which is taken case by case. Nothing is objectionable because it's talented people doing good work.
Yeah.
But the problem is that it's happening every single time over and over and over.
Yeah, it's strange to me that Oppenheimer hasn't gotten in trouble for this. And I guess it's just because no one, like, it just takes one person to say it for it to become a thing. Mm-hmm. And for some, even though, like, they're constantly talking about their Jewishness in that movie, and it's like Tom Conti, Cillian Murphy,
Emily Blunt,
and Robert Downey Jr., who I don't know, is he part Jewish? I don't know, but I don't think he is. Emily Blunt, I think she's like the Shiksa wife. Okay. I don't remember.
I haven't seen it yet.
Jewish. I don't even recall. Part of it is that it's part of the long history of Jews in Hollywood doing their best to not make a fuss because...
Well, that's the thing. There are any number of Jews in Hollywood, but the Jews there are rarely given those parts.
But also the tradition from the beginning was to not make yourself known, right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
When they weren't allowed into country clubs, they just quietly built their own. And... A lot of the measures like creating the censor board to avoid Washington censoring movies, a lot of that was people wanting to keep the goyish powers that be out of their private business, because this is a group of people who are, they, you know, those studio heads, they came from Eastern Europe. They grew up knowing what pogroms were, either because they experienced them or their parents did. And like, it's just, I'm explaining Jewishness to you, which I'm really enjoying.
I think
some of it has to do with this cultural tradition of just laying low.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing about the Cooper thing, and, you know, I personally think Bradley Cooper is very talented and passionate, and I am curious to see the movie Nose or No Nose. But it's also dovetailing with very recent upticks in anti-Semitism that nobody seems to be paying attention to.
Well, it's also a strange choice because Leonard Bernstein did not have this prominent nose where it's like that was something that defined him.
I hope that this movie exists in the Lydia Tarr universe. So I hope at one point this movie flashes to like a young Lydia at home and wherever she was, Long Island, watching the Leonard Bernstein concert.
Yeah. People also talk about how in the old days, there weren't a lot of, the studio heads didn't want Jewish girls in their movies because they didn't want to treat their own women the way they treated the goyish women that walked
away. Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Oof, okay.
Yeah, which is also, I think, an ingredient in this, in what we have in terms of the culture today.
But I mean, the baseline is like, again, the baseline is case by case. It's not a big deal, but it's the fact that it's over and over and over.
Well, and that it's weird. I mean, it's one thing to say that you're casting people. I mean, people will always be cast if they are name recognition. That'll always be the first reason and the most prominent reason to cast
someone. And who else was going to get a Leonard Bernstein biopic made?
Well, there are famous Jewish guys, but it is strange given that you're not that hard pressed to find people who are of part Jewish heritage in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. So it is strange. I don't care about this Leonard Bernstein movie, but in terms of the amount of movies I've seen where Ryan Reynolds plays a Jewish guy and woman in gold, you couldn't sell a Helen Mirren Miramax movie with anyone else that you cast in that role. You know, at least find someone who at least is credibly Jewish, which I don't even know what that means. And I'm sure I can get picked apart for saying that, but Jesus
and it's
Christ.
And it's, but also Julie Klausner says, like, it's something that you feel. It's not something that you can say, oh, this one is wrong and this one is right.
Absolutely.
It's just something that case by case, sometimes it feels right and sometimes it feels wrong.
Yeah.
Tony Shalhoub as the dad in Maisel feels right.
Yeah. And so does Helen Mirren feels right enough. I don't feel like it's a ridiculous choice because she's not like waspy, right?
She's about to do Golda Meir.
Well, she borrowed Bradley Cooper's nose to do it too. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just because she's the biggest name that they could get to sell
of that age
incredibly sexy biopic. But she's Russian, you know what I mean? Like, she is ethnic. She's not, it's not like it's Judi Dench or somebody.
Yeah. Do I have anything else to say about this movie? No, glad I watched it. Glad I watched it. Glad it exists. Glad it fits into the bigger picture for these people, but glad I don't have to watch it again.
Yeah, I certainly was not thrilled to sit through it again. It felt even longer the second time. And again, I don't think it's as bad as what I had read, but I also am not.
Hardly. No. Yeah.
And also because it's full of people who I love and can enjoy in way better experiences in just about every case. Yeah. You know,
I do find it funny that Eileen Brennan got her start as a Broadway ingenue. Doing romantic soprano roles.
I mean,
then became who she became on screen.
And I say this as someone who fully approves of her, but like, was she more palatable from further away? Like, she has a character actress look to her.
Yeah,
she's not soft, pretty. You know, mm-hmm. She's.
I think maybe part of it is her vocal range, because she does have a, you know, at that age she did have like a lush soprano voice.
Right. Yeah, and like big.
So maybe
hair.
That was it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I guess it's also because we were all introduced to her in the 70s as this, like, hard-bitten. She always played, like, you know, the snappy waitress, or I think The Sting is one of her first big breakthrough roles.
I mean, I think of Private Benjamin and Clue.
Always, of course. Private yeah. Benjamin is how she's a Spice Girl. And Clue, yeah, and this is her and Madeline Kahn reunited in Clue mm-hmm. as well.
They were pals.
Oh, were they? Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, you can enjoy Bert and so many other things in the 70s. You can enjoy Madeline. Even as a chanteuse, a goofy comedic chanteuse, you can enjoy her better in other things. And you can enjoy Sybil in so much other mm-hmm. stuff as well.
My favorite unheralded Madeline Kahn musical moment is in Mix Nuts when she's trapped in the elevator and she does the I'm trapped in the elevator rap with a toy xylophone.
It's the only part of that movie I remember. And I think I turned it off after that point because I had to. I've never finished that movie, but I've always
you had to die. To,
yeah.
it's not great, but there's a humdinger of a scene of Madeline Kahn improvising rap music.
Well, and I love Nora Ephron's brain. So like, I'm happy to spend time in her world, even in her bad stuff. Although Lucky Numbers is a lot to ask of anyone, but yeah, I do love, you know, I love mm-hmm. my witty Jewish broads. You know this about me.
I do, honey.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. Well, that's that. Daniel, thank you as always. Thank you for suggesting we do this, because I knew that that we would have a good time talking about it. I'm
glad we did.
Talking Madeline Kahn with you. And thank you for your...
Stay tuned for our next episode, American Tale 2, Fievel Goes West.
Do you remember when Beauty and the Beast got nominated for Best Picture and Billy Crystal said Fievel did not take the news well? He tried to erase himself.
You thought anti-Semitism was done in Hollywood.
Well, think about what Madeline Kahn movie you want to do next, because she was in plenty of bad ones. But until then, we will we'll reconnect very soon. Tell our listeners where they can find you, follow you.
You can find me on Instagram at KrolikD, KROLIKD, or give Gay for Pay Productions a follow. We've got some stuff coming up.
Oh, yes, you do. And you can find me at Bill Antoniou on both X and Instagram and Threads. I opened a Threads. I don't
know.
I don't know.
Are people using it?
Not really. Most people are moving their Twitter to what I like to call Blueski, but it's Blue Sky. But the way the .com looks, it looks like Blueski.
Blueski, smiling at me. Yeah, that's what it sounds like. I just watched Liza Minnelli live from London, which was taped in the late 1980s, and she does a glorious twinning of Blue Skies, and I'm so excited.
Oh, interesting. That is very interesting. All right, well, listeners can look out for that. In the meantime, follow us on Tumblr, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, visit us at badgaymovies.com, write to us badgaymovies2013@gmail.com. See you next week. Bye.
Bye.